WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, John Updike on religion and the movies and how they figure into his new novel and his life. The novel and the Beauty of the Lilies opens in 1910 with a minister who has lost his faith and ends in the 80s with his great-grandson who has joined a cult group. Also today, total risk, freedom, discipline. We talk with curator Mark Rosenthal about the new exhibit on 20th century abstract art at the Guggenheim in New York. And book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews Lieutenant Nun, the memoir of a Basque transvestite in the New World. Written in the 17th century, it's the autobiography of a young woman who passed as a man. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Frank Stacio. Pat Buchanan says he's the candidate of the working class and the one who can beat Bill Clinton in November. He's the winner of yesterday's New Hampshire primary, with Bob Dole and Lamar Alexander in second and third place. Fed Chairman Alan Greenspan clarified remarks he made yesterday concerning short-term interest rates. In Senate testimony today, Greenspan said further cuts are still possible. UPI's Pi Chamberlain has details.
The financial markets that sagged yesterday when Greenspan failed to promise an interest rate cut picked up today when he said, in effect, maybe he would and maybe he would not cut rates. He went straight down the middle, but did emphasize several times that the economy is soft.
We are in a soft patch in which, even though the probabilities of recession don't reach the likely, they do rise.
Financial analysts said before this week's two appearances in Congress by Greenspan that small interest rate cuts were likely this spring. Several said after this appearance that the cuts still seem likely. Pi Chamberlain, Capitol Hill.
A top French nuclear expert has told Parliament that the nuclear tests conducted in the South Pacific have produced radioactive waste, but he says that does not threaten the environment. France conducted its final test last month. Lynn Terry reports from Paris.
The official in charge of the test, Jacques Bouchard, said there were about 100 cavities in the French testing site that contained plutonium and fission material. He said the total amount corresponded to 1 cubic meter of radioactive waste. Bouchard said this quantity is not a threat and affirmed that even if there were an accident and 10% leaked out, it would not affect the local population. He didn't mention the impact an accident might have on marine life, which is a key source of food in the area. He also didn't explain how scientists could measure the quantity of radioactive material in the cavities. In the past, they've said the explosion sealed all radioactive material inside the cavities as if they were in a vacuum-packed container. Bouchard confirmed that in the coming weeks, a team of nuclear experts from the International Atomic Energy Commission would visit the site to check for contamination. For National Public Radio, I'm Lynn Terry in Paris.
Two crewmen are feared dead in a train derailment in Leadville, Colorado. The freight train left the rails, spilling acid down a mountainside. No word on how strong the acid is or what danger it poses, but a highway has been closed. The oil tanker Sea Empress is still leaking oil. So far, more than 19 million gallons have poured into the waters off the coast of Wales. Battered by high seas and strong winds, the ship is grounded only 300 yards from shore and not far from an important habitat for seabirds and marine mammals. So far, several attempts to control the vessel since it went aground on Thursday have failed. On Wall Street at this hour, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up more than 26 points at 5484.9 on volume of 334 million shares. You're listening to NPR News. A Washington-based consumer advocacy group says breakfast served at family-style restaurant chains in the U.S. tend to be high in fat and calories. Craig Windham reports.
The Center for Science and the Public Interest checked breakfast at chains such as Denny's, International House of Pancakes, and Bob's Big Boy. The most popular breakfast, such as Denny's Grand Slam, is a meal with two eggs, sausage, bacon, and pancakes. The researchers found that breakfast has over 1,000 calories, 49 grams of fat, plus 2 days' worth of cholesterol. A nutritionist with the center says a Grand Slam-type breakfast is a nutritional strikeout. A spokesman for Denny's says customers can lower the fat and calories by requesting substitutes such as fresh fruit and reduced-calorie syrup. The survey found the best breakfast choice at the restaurants was a hot or cold cereal platter with juice, toast, and jam. But for people unwilling to forego all their fatty favorites, the survey found that a small order of ham has less than a tenth the fat of 4 sausage links, and hash browns have half as much fat as French fries. I'm Craig Windham in Washington.
New research shows that men who have cancerous prostates removed have a 1 in 3 chance of needing still more therapy. Surgery is often used to cure prostate cancer, which is the second leading killer of men. A study of more than 3,000 Medicare patients finds 35% received radiation treatment, hormone injections, or had one or both testicles removed within 5 years of the original surgery. The study appeared in today's Journal of the National Cancer Institute. 2 cosmonauts were lifted into space today aboard a Soyuz spacecraft on a mission that marks a new era in international space cooperation. The Soyuz is due to dock with the Mir orbital station in 2 days to start a 5-month expedition in conjunction with U.S. and French space programs. And air quality officials in California plan to take the Ku Klux Klan to court, charging their cross-burnings violate air pollution standards. I'm Frank Stacio, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. John Updike's new novel, In the Beauty of the Lilies, is about what we've searched for in religion and movies in 20th century America. The novel follows the members of one family over 4 generations. It begins in 1910 with a Methodist minister who loses his faith. His son Teddy becomes a mailman. Teddy's daughter Alma becomes a movie star. Her son joins a cult group. New York Times book critic Michiko Kakutani described the novel as possibly Updike's finest, a book that forces us to reassess the American dream and the crucial role that faith and the longing for faith has played in the shaping of the national soul. And The Beauty of the Lilies is on the bestseller list. Updike's 4 rabbit novels were recently published together in one volume by the Everyman's Library. Updike has won the Pulitzer Prize, the National Book Award, the American Book Award, and the National Book Critics Circle Award. I asked him about the parallels he sees between religion and the movies.
Well, they both involve going into a building and sitting all facing the same direction and having something happen in front of you. The 2 buildings in the town of my growing up were fairly close together, the Lutheran Church and the Shillington Movie Theater, and it was in the movie theater, really, that I was getting the messages about how to live and getting ecstasies of a kind and thrills, and role models were being presented, and people like Errol Flynn and George Sanders were realer to me, surely, than Jesus Christ. So it seemed to me that in my own life, at least, because I was an ardent child moviegoer, that the movies had taken over some of the cultural role that the church occupied in earlier times. They both involve light, too. There's this sort of mystical thing. I think I describe it not once but several times in the book of sitting in the darkened theater waiting for the light to begin and the little buzz, and then it happens. It's a weird and wonderful thing going to the movies.
In a recent piece in The New Yorker about Lana Turner, the movie star, you write about the, quote, mystic communion that pre-television Hollywood enjoyed with its huge American audience. I thought that sense of that mystic communion relates to your novel, too.
Yes, it's a period I remember most vividly. And I also remember my parents going. We didn't have many pleasures or frivolities in the Depression. My father was a school teacher of But anybody could afford the movies, or almost anybody could afford the movies, and I began to go with them at quite a young age, maybe 3. And that sensation of going with parents who I now realize were quite young, although they seemed enormous and ageless to me, going and sitting there, often sat between them. It was sort of meaningful and beautiful in a way, and it kind of put a blessing on the movie experience for me, so that when I began to go alone or began to go with other appears, somehow that blessing lingered. I always felt good. It was okay to go to the movies. And my parents, my mother, who was not very permissive in many regards, was oddly permissive about my going to the movies. I saw far more than my classmates did because I could go on a Monday night as well as on a Friday night.
Wow.
Yeah.
Gee, that's permissive.
That was permissive. Yeah. It was. The movies, I remember it well. There were two shows, 7 and 9. And I, of course, didn't go to the 9 o'clock, but I did go to the 7. And then it would be light when I went down Philadelphia Avenue and dark when I'd come back. And I would run because I'd be scared. I was quite scared, not after a horror movie, but after almost any movie. But I would get home safely and in the dark and go to bed.
I guess that John Updike and his new novel is called In the Beauty of the Lilies. Your novel begins when movies are in their infancy, when D.W. Griffith is making movies. And the character we first meet is a minister who is losing his faith. And I want you to tell us why he's losing his faith.
Well, he's a late Victorian who's losing his faith for the same reasons that a lot of Victorians were shaken. Some hung on, some left, but it was Darwin's theory struck a devastating blow, but there were other blows as well. The German scholarship into the Old and New Testament, the showing that this was another book with certain sources and all that in an age that in some way was the epitome of European confidence and colonializing and going out there and converting the savage at the same time. The faith was being undermined in this intellectual way at home. So specifically in the novel, he reads from Robert Ingersoll, who was a militant American atheist, the son of a minister, as many militant atheists seem to be, who had written a lot of pamphlets and a couple books, and he reads him to refute him for a troubled parishioner, but in fact he realizes that Ingersoll is quite right, that this God does not and should not exist, and he's not able to go back on it, though he gets a lot of advice saying why he could stay in the ministry, that after all, what is faith and their ways of interpreting it and all of the liberal Protestant arguments that have kept many a man in the clerical robes. But there's something stubborn in the Wilmot character, as I conceive it, which leads him to demit seems to be the word, and for Presbyterians to give up the ministry. And it's not easy to demit. Once in, very hard to get out, but he does do the right things and gets out. And of course, and not to give away the whole plot, he discovers there's nowhere else for him. The church was his profession, was his livelihood, and he's kind of out of work and dies young.
You've never had your faith shaken in such a way to have, you know, left the church, have you?
I've clung to what faith I have. I wasn't an especially devout kid. I was sort of impatient with the whole thing, that kind of varnished basement Sunday school with these sickly or oily pamphlets, illustrations of people in purple robes. But the Lutheran, Luther's stamp somehow remained on me, and at college, I often, or somewhat often, attended the local Lutheran church, married a Unitarian minister's daughter. As a compromise, we joined the Congregational Church in the New England town, and my second wife is an Episcopalian, and I've become one. So I've been around denomination-wise, but I've never been a Presbyterian. I had to do some reading about what Presbyterians believed as opposed to other people. And it is the creed that most distinctly inherited Calvin's curious theology. I say curious only because any theology is somewhat curious, but Calvin's notion that an absolutely omnipotent God must know everything and have determined everything already, you would think this would create a sense of fatalism in people, somewhat like Islam or some of the Oriental religions, but it had the opposite effect somehow of creating a spirit of enterprise that made America, that helped make America what it is now.
The second generation main character in your book, Teddy, doesn't really like the movies. He thinks that the motion pictures embrace the chaos that sensible men and women in their ordinary lives plotted to avoid. Do you understand that sentiment at all?
Yes, quite well, in fact. I get frightened in the movies, and even Clarence sees a glimmer. I mean, somehow they present life to you in a naked way. You can't hide from the basic human facts, sex, death, violence, failure. I used to dread, for example, in those old 30s and 40s movies, scenes of social embarrassment when Gary Cooper, although he's going to win out in the end, wears the wrong tuxedo to some party. And there are a lot of those scenes because it was a very class-conscious world. And I couldn't stand them. I almost had to avert my eyes from the screen. I could never go to horror movies blithely like some of my tougher peers. I would get scared in the previews of the Frankenstein movies. And even during a fairly innocuous movie, I will become frightened of the existential facts. I will feel as though I'm sitting over an abyss. You don't get that so much when you go with somebody, but I did see Leaving Las Vegas the other day by myself and again had that feeling of terror in the middle of it.
What gave you the feeling of terror there?
Well, it's a depressing movie, as you know. It's about a man steadily drinking himself to death, and his girlfriend is a Las Vegas hooker who gets beaten up in quite a horrific scene, but it's not the overtly horrific scene so much. It's, I don't know, some of the steady beat of these lives transpiring in front of you and being finite. The film will be over. There'll be blackness on the screen.
John Updike is my guest, and his new novel is called In the Beauty of the Lilies. Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with John Updike. His new novel is called In the Beauty of the Lilies. Now, I find it very interesting that, you know, a writer like you who has always had questions of religion going through their books, questions of, you know, what a moral life is, and, I mean, you are a man of faith, that you're one of the people who has also most explored that territory of, especially early on, you know, using sexuality to describe character, which some people just might inherently see as being an immoral thing to do in literature.
The Lutheran denomination is not especially puritanical. It's not a Calvinist one. And in any case, religion and sex are both intimate activities that are somewhat allied. They are both reaffirmations of the self against an enormous cold world and so they are forms also expressing our most private energy. I didn't see any conflict. God made the world, as Essie somewhere reflects. He knows what happens, so I wasn't bringing any news that wasn't there. It's one's duty as a writer to describe the world. It's a kind of giving praise, and that includes describing it in its cruel and intimate, and I was going to say sordid, but that's a sort of value judgment word. But yeah, you've got to describe all you know. Tell all you know. That's the only way to praise the Lord that I know.
Well, one of the things that your readers might find paradoxical is that, you know, a man of faith like yourself is writing in your new novel about people who are so lost. And, you know, it's hard to have faith in your new novel.
Hard to have faith in general.
I mean, everybody's, yeah, but everybody's lost in your new novel in one way or another.
Life has looked at it a certain way. It's tragic, yes, life. And we do get lost. And even if we find ourselves and find success for a while, that too leaks away. But that's all in the Bible, too. I mean, read Ecclesiastes. There is no holding your worldly success. Yet I didn't find this book a depressing book. It's rather merry in a way.
I didn't say it was depressing.
You know, these people do have their successes and the positive things. Alma does get what she wants, and Teddy, in a way, gets what he wants. You know, it's a book about people getting what they want, in a way, and when you get what you want, you find it, too, has its debit, its downside. But I think the God of this novel is fairly kind to the citizens of the novel.
I'm interested in what your religious upbringing was like. You were brought up in the Lutheran Church, went to Sunday school.
Well, the Lutheran Church is sort of the establishment church in that part of Pennsylvania. It's a heavily German, and the Germans brought with them Lutheranism. My father was not a Lutheran by birth. He was a Presbyterian, but my mother, who was of Berks County, was, and he became a Lutheran, and a good Lutheran. He taught Sunday school. He was a deacon. He was always going off to committee meetings, vestry meetings. I'm not sure it was called the vestry. At any rate, he was an upstanding citizen in the town and became an upstanding citizen. So I suppose his example of being a good churchman and the fact that I loved and admired him has led me to be more patient with the established church than many of my peers. I obviously, it doesn't take a terrible amount of intelligence to see that the faith is indeed a faith. Somewhere Ian Ionescu, the Romanian playwright, puts it as well as anybody: if God is in heaven, why can't we see the soles of his feet? So it takes no great brain to see that this is a structure built on faith purely. And the older you get, the more reasons, the more oppressively worldly and secular and godless the world appears. And on the other side, there's only your own need, really. So I don't know. The Lutheran. No, I was an indifferent Sunday school person, and the other kids would get perfect attendance pins, and I would get a pencil saying "Kint's Funeral Home." It seemed to me that I had been as faithful as they. But in some way, I think even then, the Lutheran Church didn't quite trust me, and they were right. I'm not quite trustworthy.
What do you mean?
Well, I'm not an ideal churchgoer, and I do have a sort of like the Wilmots. I have a kind of rebellious streak. I've been a loner in my career and have resisted joining. I can remember once going down to the Lutheran church. I knew that all of the pretty girls, all the vital girls, were in this particular youth group, and I was going to join up shyly, and I went and I looked in the window, and it was the Halloween party, and they all had costumes on. So I said, I can't go in there without a costume, turned around and walked home. And that was more or less the way my relationship with that church went. Still, I remained loyal to it in my fashion.
Now, what was your idea of religion when you were young? I think for a lot of children, religion is it's a code. It's a set of the things that if you do, you're punished, and if you don't do them, you're praised. Or, you know, the other things, if you do them, you're praised, and if you don't do them, you're punished.
I know that's all there, yet it isn't what struck me. I remember it as these stories about people in various colored robes, purple and green and so on, with bare feet or sandals on their feet, doing these fairly violent and distressing things in a kind of deep historical dust. And yet that we were all gathering together to listen to these stories struck me as somehow beautiful. So somehow wonderful, and it was entirely voluntary. Unlike the public school, nobody was making you do this. Nobody was making these grown men and women show up to teach us. So I think I was struck by a certain graciousness, a certain something extra about the Christian church, that it was an institution that was superfluous in many obvious ways and yet was there for us.
Did you have ministers who could preach a good sermon, who were interesting to listen to?
My mind tends to wander during sermons, but in, I hope, a fruitful way. I often kind of daydream about what I'm writing. I've heard a lot of sermons in my life. I don't remember Vic Kroninger's sermons, except that he was a solidly built, square-faced man with a red face who really put a lot of fire into every word he pronounced. What those words were, I don't know. And I've heard some very skillful preachers since at Harvard and elsewhere. But I'm not so much of a Protestant that I think you go for the sermon. You don't go for the lecture. You go for something more. There's some magic happening here that you're trying to ally yourself with.
Now, what about the Bible as text? Did you enjoy reading the Bible when you were young?
I've never read the Bible through and don't find it a terribly consoling document, actually. When I, in the purposes of the last chapter here, I began to read the Bible, I was struck again by how horrific it is, how full of violence. And to get these quotes from Jesse about violence, he didn't have to look very far, so it's in a way very disturbing disturbing and displeasing book. I was in love with the new. I think most children are. You adopt popular culture as sort of an alternative parent when you're a child. And to me, real life, the action was with Mickey Mouse and Errol Flynn and the radio programs, Jack Benny and so on. I mean, this was what meant something to me and not the Bible stories. And yet a few of them stuck in my mind. And I think the whole saga from Abraham to Joseph, that set of four generations, was somewhere in the back of my mind when I tried to write my own generational saga. So the notion that there is a kind of thread of transaction here was what motivated me to write the book. I'm not sure it's what the reader will get out of it. In a way, it ends with a terrible thud, doesn't it?
You know, the movie star character that you write about, part of your interest is how celebrities can live outside of the constraints that society agrees on. You've had a measure of celebrity yourself. Do you feel like that's enabled you, or that you've ever even wanted to live outside any of those constraints?
I've interpreted my franchise to be a writer as kind of a businessman. I don't put on a suit in the morning, and that right there is a kind of freedom and an anti-convention. But I've worked at it fairly steadily and see steadiness as part of the job. So yes, there are certain ways in which the society does not expect me to live up to their strictest standards the way a school teacher or a minister does. But my environment has tended to be small towns, so that as a good citizen, I've tended to go along with small town society and mores. I just find a small town easier to live in. One is, in a strange way, freer. I'm not drawn to the great flesh pots. Of course, at 63, who would be? But even when I was 33, L.A. or New York just seemed to me ways to waste your time. So my morality comes down to trying not to waste your time, I guess.
So you're still writing at an incredibly productive.
Well, it may seem productive to you, and
yes, it does seem productive to me.
For that, but to me, it feels very much a staggering from one fallible idea to the next. I do try to do a little something every day, but it's by no means as smooth or as hectic as you might think. I mean, this book took a long time, well over a year to put together, and all of them have almost felt like, you know, my last book, as though I have no more ideas. I'm not exactly bubbling over with inspirations. What inspirations I have, I tend to harbor and nurse along and sometimes even repeat them. I try to be thrifty. My model in this is somebody like a painter like Cézanne, who painted those apples and Mont Saint-Victoire over and over again. You know, there's always something new by looking at essentially the same human adventure.
John Updike, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Thank you. Pleasure.
John Updike's new novel is called In the Beauty of the Lilies. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. Celebrating 25 years of radio excellence, this is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, abstract art and how each generation of artists in the 20th century has redefined it. We talk with Mark Rosenthal, curator of the abstraction show at the Guggenheim in New York. Also, the true story of a young woman in the late 1500s who passed as a man and led a swashbuckling life. Book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews Lieutenant Nunn. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Curator Mark Rosenthal says that in the art world, the 20th century brought a previously unimaginable rupture with the past, abstraction. Rosenthal has put together a major show on the history of abstract art. It's on exhibit at the Guggenheim Museum in New York. Rosenthal is also curator of 20th century art at the National Gallery of Art in Washington, D.C. I asked him what we mean when we call art abstract.
Well, the lingo is difficult to use. In fact, what I'm meaning by it is pure abstraction, meaning art that does not seem to have reference points in the visible world, in the world that we see in front of us with things on tables and people sitting on chairs and so forth. There seems to be no reference to that world in abstract art.
You've called your show Total Risk, Freedom, Discipline. That's actually a quote from the artist Eva Hess. Why did you want to use that as your title?
Well, I spent months and months and months trying to come up with a literary, something better than cute, subtitle for the exhibition. And I played around with a lot of words and thoughts. But I came across this quote of Eva Hess's, and it so captured so much of what goes on in abstraction and the ideas that many artists had expressed. To begin with, the artists in the beginning of the century in particular, but even more recently than that, felt that they were on a kind of edge of an abyss, that they were now doing something that had never been done before, like going up in an airplane or something for Orville and Wilbur. They were trying to do something that was unthought of, unheard of. So they felt that they were taking a risk. They were taking a risk in terms of what kind of art they were producing in relation to all of history. And they were unquestionably taking a professional risk in making art that did not have an audience. But time after time, these artists, and now I'm talking about the artists throughout the century, abstract artists, would say that the reason they did it was because they felt the potential of incredible personal freedom, the freedom to do anything they want. And that has two levels. One level, of course, is free from subject matter, free from narrative. There's no reason or no need now to illustrate a narrative idea. So the freedom was in that limited way there. But secondly, they saw it as expressive freedom. The freedom to express sensations, moods, things that don't have words attached to them the way narratives do. Hess's use of the word discipline is perfect because, of course, doing this isn't a matter of a free-for-all, being an abstract artist. One has to have command of one's craft. In other words, discipline with regard to one's media. It's the same as sitting down at a piano if you know how to play and sitting down at a piano if you don't know how to play. And the great pianists know how to play, have discipline, know how to work their media.
Where does abstraction begin?
It begins in a fundamental way. It gets rolling with the artist called Vasily Kandinsky, a Russian who moved to Munich early in his career, gave up the practice of law to become an artist, went to Munich, and started to dream about a new kind of art. He was inspired by various things that already existed that sort of laid the groundwork, but most people give Kandinsky pride of place as having, as it were, invented abstraction. I think worrying about the precise date really isn't so important, in fact, because one can point to so many prophets and progenitors in a small way. But Kandinsky is the one who got it rolling, talked about it as an ideology, wrote about it, so on and so forth. He was quickly joined by what one could describe as the two other musketeers of abstraction, a Dutchman named Piet Mondrian and another Russian who remained back in Russia, in Moscow, Kazimir Malevich. And the three of them were really the start.
Describe Mondrian's work, because a lot of our listeners who don't know the work by name will recognize his work when you describe it. Recognize it in part because it even became the basis for dress patterns.
It became
so popular.
Mondrian's work is probably familiar to lots of people without knowing it. It's the art that's basically one would call geometric, meaning there's lots of squares and rectangles of color and white, and thick bars of black lines. And these are all utilized to create a kind of dynamic equilibrium type composition.
The Impressionists and the Cubists departed from realism in the sense that it related to forms in real life, but it wasn't a literal representation of it. And in a way, you know, I think that Cubism and Impressionism, Cubism in particular, trained viewers to look at paintings and then stand back and say, what is it? What is the artist really thinking about? Ah, yes, I think I see two eyes and a nose. It must be a woman. Or, ah, yes, I think I see a garden here. You know, and I think in a way, viewers really got used to trying to project subject matter onto paintings, even when it wasn't supposed to relate in a literal way, in a figurative way, to the real world.
Well, there's no doubt that each of these events, Impressionism, Cubism, led to abstraction. There's utterly no question of that. But there nevertheless is a very great dramatic break. The Cubist painters, for instance, who were at work at the same time as Kandinsky, Mondrian, and Malevich, would not cross the line. There was, in effect, a line drawn in the sand. And what Picasso said about pure abstraction was that he was disgusted by it because it had left the world altogether. Even at its most abstract, the Cubist painting kind of titillates or seduces a viewer to think about where the artist began. And in fact, as you catch sight of that mustache and you realize, gee, there must be a man there, then you're led to think, well, then maybe that shape just below must be his elbow. And, oh, wait, look, that must be the table on which his elbow is leaning. And you start to see the way the artist abstracted from, which is the source of the word abstraction, as I use it, meaning starting with a subject and turning it into the materials of art. But I think you're right in the sense that Impressionism and Cubism sort of prepared the way. And in fact, Kandinsky, sort of the hero of the story, the first hero of the story, often talked about how it was a Monet painting of a haystack that really spurred him forward, because he looked at that painting and at first didn't see that there was a subject. He just saw it as fabulous colored light.
Well, why did Kandinsky want to break with the past and create an art that had no figurative basis in reality?
Well, there are many issues. Some of the key ones include the fact that he distrusted materialism. He looked around himself. He saw the Industrial Revolution moving into full swing. He saw photography capturing the appearances of the world. And he didn't like it. He felt that the human soul was getting ground up by all this concern with materialistic issues. He identified materialistic issues with traditional painting that still had subject matter, believing that that kind of art, in effect, celebrated a material world, which obviously it does, even if it's implicit. What he wanted to do was get at the things that were underlying the human condition, the human soul. In certain ways, these issues were religious, but religious with what one might say is a capital R, I suppose. In other words, not specific to one religion so much as spiritual. And he wanted to paint those kinds of things. In other words, he wanted a subject matter. He still wanted a subject that one might perceive, but these were subjects that were ineffable. They couldn't be reduced to a few words, a man carrying a cross or so forth, and so forth.
And Mondrian, one of the other early abstractionists, what were the ideas behind his geometric colored forms?
If Kandinsky was interested in sort of divine subject matter, Mondrian was interested in nature. But whereas he started his career painting trees and landscapes, what he soon realized was that really there were underlying rhythms of the universe that caused the universe to move and to grow and to die, in fact. And he felt that all the rhythms of the universe, in fact, all the issues of the world could be summarized in a number of compositional effects that all could be stated with the meeting of the horizontal and the vertical, that even male and female could come down to horizontal versus vertical, but everything could, land versus the cosmos, so on and so forth. So he then set out to make an art which mirrored the way the world operated. In effect, was the world in operation. And he felt that by creating paintings that had constant movement, this idea of dynamic equilibrium, he was in effect making objects that were microcosms of the world order.
Now, it's interesting that he should have this very profound reason for painting the work that he did. And yet, eventually, that work can become reduced to the pattern for a dress or, you know, something that wallpaper uses as its basic design. Do you feel that you or that most viewers would look at a Mondrian and get a sense of his intentions?
I think that it's finally not important whether a viewer gets what Mondrian was after. Mondrian hopes we do, but most of all, I think what we might get is the spirit of what he's doing. Because after all, what he's dealing with is something ineffable. It doesn't have to do with words. And so then we come to the subject of how do we experience abstract works of art? And that has to do, for me, with a kind of willing suspension of disbelief. To me, it's no different than taking a walk in a fabulous landscape, standing above the ocean on some promontory in Big Sur or something like that, or listening to a new piece of music that a friend might play. It's a matter of simply being open to these things and taking it in and enjoying the stimuli created by the work of art without preconceptions.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Mark Rosenthal, and he curated the History of Abstraction show that's now at the Guggenheim in New York. Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
My guest is Mark Rosenthal. He curated the History of Abstract Art in the 20th Century show that's now at the Guggenheim. There's also a catalog in which he has quite a long and interesting essay about abstract art. And you've already referred to some of the spiritual motivations behind the work of the early abstractionists. But abstraction later took on many different forms and had many different sources of inspiration. Maybe you could talk a little bit about those shifting inspirations, some of the more formal and intellectual reasons for abstraction.
Well, it's an amazing aspect of abstraction, and surely the source of its staying power through the century, that each generation seems to instill in the style a different set of ideas so that it's always pliant and pliable and useful at each point in history. For instance, in the 20s, in Holland, Germany, and Russia, the abstract style became an expression of the new governments and new ways of thinking, and it was an ideological extension of the government's activities. Basically, it was utopian, and the artists were utopian. At that point in time, being an abstract artist showed that you were in tune with the new government and the new ways of operating and so forth. That whole approach was completely rejected by the time the Americans came around to abstraction in the 40s. I shouldn't say that they came around to it then, but that a big push happened in the 40s and 50s. The so-called New York School or abstract expressionist group of artists hated the word abstract, in fact, even though they were abstract, because the abstraction handed to them was the type I just described. And for these artists now, utopian dreaming led directly to World War II. So they had no interest in that kind of thinking. Also, abstraction in the 20s and 30s had been used as a kind of, became used as a kind of design principle, so that artists who made abstract paintings might also make screwdrivers in a well-designed way. Well, in the 40s and 50s, the so-called New York School had other ideas for abstraction. They wanted to use it as a vehicle of personal expressiveness, individual personal expressiveness. They had no interest whatsoever in aligning themselves with contemporary society. They felt contemporary society was bankrupt. They felt alienated. They were members of the early Beat generation, for all intents and purposes. And so abstraction was now instilled with this kind of personal liberation.
Would you put Jackson Pollock in this category?
Right. The artist I'm thinking of with regard to this stance was where Jackson Pollock, Willem de Kooning, Clifford Still, Mark Rothko, they were very interested still in all kinds of spiritual type subjects such as Kandinsky, but it was all a kind of foggy, emotional kind of spirituality. It was a different animal than what the earlier group was. These people were followed by a generation which would include Frank Stella, Ellsworth Kelly, and so forth. Artists who were turned off by the kind of emotionalism of the abstract expressionists. One frequent cliche is that they straightened out the lines. They straightened out the gestural lines. That's a cliche by way of explaining that they sought a different kind of beauty that was, in effect, impersonal. If abstract expressionism was personal, they wanted an impersonal style that was nevertheless magisterial. They worked on a very large scale with very impressive seeming compositions. That group was then followed, and of course I'm doing a kind of broad brush approach here, that group was then followed by what are called the minimalists, who in fact were very interested in the work of the 20s, and they were also desirous of showing that abstraction could relate to contemporary life. And the way they did that was by using contemporary materials, corrugated steel, all kinds of things. And the result was other kinds of beauty. In fact, what we're dealing with, I'm sort of jumping around here, In fact, what we're dealing with is that at each point in the century, there's a different kind of beauty at work, or a different kind of aesthetic of beauty at work, and that related to these ideas.
Now, the show is at the Guggenheim in New York. I want you to describe the Guggenheim's space and what challenge that space presented to you when you were hanging the paintings.
Well, if the Parthenon is the source of half the public buildings in the world, the Guggenheim has been the source of half the buildings in the 20th century. Every time you walk into a building constructed in the 20th century that has an atrium, the chances are it derives back to the Guggenheim. The Guggenheim is a fabulous central space building which is surrounded by a ramp that circles upward or downward depending on which way you're moving. And so you look at the pictures on the outer edge and you go to the edge of the ramp you're walking on and you could look across this large central space, very dramatic. And of course that's been the source of so many hotels and convention centers and other museums. This building is by, of course, Frank Lloyd Wright and set a kind of standard that's been copied over and over again. It's a complicated building to hang in because Wright was almost crazy in the way he made every single space not like another space. You can never depend on the dimensions of one space being the same as an adjacent space that more or less looks identical. Wright would change it by a couple of inches. So it becomes complicated to install pictures there. There are all sorts of idiosyncrasies. On the other hand, when an exhibition looks good at the Guggenheim Museum, and it doesn't always look good there, but when an exhibition looks good at the Guggenheim, I think it looks fabulously good because you can look across this space and see where you've come from. You can make these kinds of visual comparisons that are virtually impossible to make in any kind of normal space. And I think that's what we've accomplished here. You're able to see, say, the Maleviches just beneath the Mondrians and start to make those visual comparisons. The Mondrians hang just below the Rothkos, and so you make that sort of comparison between generations. It's a very rich experience.
I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
I appreciate being here. I've admired you for years.
Mark Rosenthal curated the abstraction show at the Guggenheim Museum in New York. He also wrote the text for the catalog. Rosenthal is curator of 20th century art at the National Gallery in Washington. Coming up, a memoir written in the 17th century by a woman who passed as a man. This is Fresh Air. In recent decades, the story of the colonization of the New World has become more diversified. History books now include accounts by Native Americans as well as conquering white European men. But never before has the story of life in the New World been told to us from the perspective of a Basque transvestite nun. Book critic Maureen Corrigan has a review of a remarkable newly translated memoir.
When Madonna finishes filming Evita, I've got the perfect project for her. Picture this. The curtain rises on late 16th century Spain. A teenage nun, played by Madonna, escapes from her convent, cuts her hair, rips up her habit, and fashions herself a pair of men's breeches, doublet, and hose. Voila! The clothes make the man. Our runaway's own mother sees her in church and doesn't recognize her. She becomes a royal page, but feeling restive after a few years, she boards a galleon bound for the West Indies and eventually winds up in Peru. There she steals, gambles, and duels. She even kills her own brother in a sword fight. Swooning women offer themselves in marriage to no avail. Our heroine becomes a soldier and leads armies into battle in Chile. Here, I envision Madonna in full armor, surrounded by hundreds of chorus boy conquistadors. Then, after decades of deception, she confesses her gender-bending secret to a local bishop. She becomes an overnight celebrity in the New World and Europe. After an audience with Pope Urban VIII, during which her virginity is verified, she gets papal permission to live out the rest of her days as a man. Fade out on Madonna singing, "What Else?" like a virgin, as the Pope and advisors do the Vatican rag. The most startling thing about this swashbuckling story is that it happens to be true. Catalina de Erasso really did cross-dress as a man and led the life of an adventurer, surviving shipwrecks, Indian attacks, and even a torture session on the rack. Sometime in the late 1620s, she wrote her unrepentant life story, which has just been translated into English by Michelle and Gabriel Steptoe under the title Lieutenant Nun, The Memoir of a Basque Transvestite in the New World. Reading it is a disorienting experience. None of the stereotypes that some feminist scholars have affixed to women's writing apply. Rather than focusing on the inner life and on her connections to other people, Catalina's narrative is action-packed and swaggering. In fact, her autobiography makes that of founding father braggart Ben Franklin look demure. Catalina's tough guy twang owes something to the translator's decision to render her voice in Huck Finn-type colloquial English, which they say resembles the Spanish of her time. Even more bewildering to contemporary readers is what Catalina doesn't say. Here, for instance, is Catalina's description of her escape. "I took the keys to the convent and I left. In a chestnut grove, I holed up for 3 days, cutting myself out a suit of clothes, and on the third night, I set off without knowing where I was going." But how did you feel is the question we denizens of a therapeutic culture shout at Catalina. Yet she remains mum on the topics of her emotions, motivations, religious defiance, peeing practices in the battlefield, and sexuality, although she does confess to a taste for other women's pretty faces. In her introduction to Lieutenant Nun, Marjorie Garber, a scholar of cross-dressing practices throughout the ages, cautions against anachronistically misreading Catalina's memoir as an allegory of a lesbian awakening or a pre-feminist woman claiming her selfhood. Not a chance. This remarkable story of a woman who transgressed the boundaries of gender and geography reminds us that the divide between past and present may be more impenetrable than we'd like to think.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed Lieutenant Nun, the memoir of a Basque transvestite in the New World. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Amy Sallet, with Alan Tu, Kathy Wolf, and Joan Tui. Research assistance from Rena Bander. I'm Terry Gross. Thank you.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Random House, publisher of Welcome to My Country, a therapist's memoir of madness by Lauren Slater. Celebrating 25 years of radio excellence, this is NPR, National Public Radio.